Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
CIA Director George Tenet has ordered his agency to revamp its procedures within 30 days to ensure that his analysts are checking their sources, that they know who's feeding them information. His demands were presented this week in an in-house speech to CIA analysts by Deputy Director for Intelligence Jamie Mischick. Doug Gell of the New York Times reported today on the new policy. He joins us now from Washington. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you.
Doug, the speech wasn't open to the public, but you did speak to people, I understand, who were there. What did they tell you?
They told me that what Ms. Mischick and Mr. Tenet have proposed within the CIA is would be a big change. It would require that the Directorate of Operations and the Directorate of Intelligence, which historically have worked very independently, cooperate a lot more to talk about who's giving them information and whether it's reliable.
You know, I guess I don't understand this as well as I should. It would seem to me that when an analyst is confronted with a bunch of information, he would know chapter and verse about who was giving him or her the information.
Well, you might think so. On the other hand, the people who gather the intelligence, the operations officers, want to be very careful about concealing their identity, making sure that it's not found out. And so the practice for years within the CIA and other agencies has been that operational details about those kinds of human sources are not shared. It's up to the operations officers to assess whether it's credible, to pass on that judgment to analysts, but not to tell them who it's coming from and what position they hold.
Yeah. Now, I understand in the speech, Deputy Director for Intelligence Jamie Mischick gave examples of pretty serious seemingly mistakes that were made in the recent past, and of course the recent past would be all about Iraq. Tell us a little about what you know.
There's one particular mistake. There was a defector interview by the Defense Intelligence Agency in early 2002 who provided some pretty good detail, they thought at the time, about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. I went back and re-interviewed him a few months later and became more skeptical. They thought that he was making up things, to be frank, and that he'd been coached by an Iraqi exile organization, the Iraqi National Congress, which had introduced him to American intelligence. They sent word out not to believe anything this guy said, but that warning got lost in the bureaucracy.
What other problems came to light in this speech, this internal speech Jamie Mischick, the deputy director, gave, Doug?
Two others. There were cases she described, without providing details, in which a single source was identified in different ways in different documents, leading intelligence analysts to believe that there were many sources when, in fact, there was just one. And in other cases, there were sources who were described as credible and regarded as such, but it turned out on further investigation that while that source might have been credible, his information came from what they call a subsource, from somebody else who really was unknown.
Now, Doug, is this sort of thing, I guess you'd say, par for the course? It's a complicated world, or is this something that seems worse than before in the Iraq context?
I guess the answer is a little of both. Intelligence is a murky business, as you know. Difficult to get answers. Intelligence analysts will tell you it's an art, not a science. It's imperfect. You can't be expected to get all the answers right. I think what happened in the case of Iraq, though, is that the hunger for answers about a place that the United States didn't know very well and hadn't penetrated very well was powerful. And in the search for answers, they may have relied on straws that were thinner than the community should have trusted.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Glad to do it.
Doug Gell is a reporter for the New York Times. You can read the entire speech given at the CIA by the deputy director on our website, here-now.org.
The Senate approved a $318 billion transportation bill yesterday, despite White House threats of a veto if the legislation exceeded $256 billion. The six-year measure would fund highways, bridges, road improvements, mass transit, and safety, and it differs from a costlier bill now pending in the House. Jeff Earle is a reporter for The Hill. He joins us from Capitol Hill. And Jeff, who were the political sparring partners in the Senate debate?
Well, unlike many debates in the Congress, this is not a partisan issue. It's a parochial issue. And the real action here was between a band of conservative Republicans who feel that the bill is too expensive and the proponents of the bill, also Republicans, in the White House.
And remind us of why some proponents are proponents. I mean, there's a unique relationship between roads and politicians.
That's absolutely right. This is a massive bill which contains funding for roads, bridges, in almost every state, in every congressional district. So members of Congress are just clamoring to get this passed.
Well, as one Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania says, never get between a congressman and asphalt because you will always get run over because this money brings jobs to their home state.
Absolutely. I mean, the amount of money here is just mind-boggling, to opponents of the bill. Mm-hmm. And this is going to lead to a construction all around the country. And there's certainly economic gains that come from having functioning infrastructure.
Right. We, of course, are speaking to you from Boston, Massachusetts, the home of the Big Dig. So we're well aware of this. But what about the concern of some of the opponents of the bill that, as one said in your column today, I can't believe members of my party are going to support a bill that the president's going to veto. What does that set up?
Well, it sets up a very interesting and cloudy situation. On the one hand, as you point out, the House has an even larger bill in the works, and the White House has a veto threat out. Now, the president hasn't vetoed anything yet in his presidency, and it would certainly be a bold political move if he were to take a stand against the Congress and veto this, arguing that it's wasteful spending.
Well, you mentioned the House bill, which is yet to pass. What happens now?
Well, first of all, Congress at some point is going to need to pass a temporary extension of expiring highway funding because mm-hmm. the old bill is going to expire. Then what's going to have to happen is the House is going to have to pass its version of the bill. And to get a bill through the floor, House leaders are going to have to negotiate with their own committee chairman. Then once the House passes a bill at this higher number, whatever that is, they're going to have to work it out with the Senate. Now, it's possible that House members and senators aren't going to be able to reach a deal, and they'll come up with nothing. It's also possible that they'll come to agreement on something that's still too high for the president, and that would set up a collision course with the White House.
Mm. You mentioned that this was infighting in the Republican Party. Where do Democrats stand on this issue?
Well, Democrats were mostly supportive of this bill. Tom Daschle, who the president is often chiding for obstruction, was actually a strong supporter of the bill. And the reason for that is the highway formula, which dictates which states get how much based on a lot of factors, is actually quite beneficial to a lot of northeastern states represented by Democrats.
Well, just briefly, in the few seconds we have, if the bill does pass in both the Senate and the House, it's an election year. Will the White House veto it, do you think?
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, on the one hand, the president would come out with his base voters looking pretty strong if he were to stand up against overspending, what he called overspending in the Congress. On the other hand, the president also wants a Republican Senate and a Republican House, which he's got now. And the members who represent those states very much want this bill so that they can campaign on this with their own voters. Mm-hmm. So there certainly could be a case of cross-political interests between the Congress and the White House.
Hmm. Well, Jeff, thanks for talking to us about it.
Good to be here.
Jeff Earl is a reporter for The Hill, a newspaper that covers the business of Capitol Hill.
At midnight in the venerable, elegant Massachusetts State House, debate on a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage was suspended. There have been three failed tries to pass an amendment. 2 days, 18 hours in all, of mostly decorous Democratic debate. Though tempers did grow short as the night grew long, a few legislators stormed out at one point, demanding there be a vote before midnight. But debate will begin all over again March 11th, when the Constitutional Convention reconvenes. So passions echoed in the old State House, as passions have many times before. After all, the keystone of the building was laid back on July 4th, 1795, by then Massachusetts Governor Sam Adams, and by one Paul Revere. Yesterday, I wondered how much of a sense of history swirls around the current debate. Here and Now producer Lindsay Crudell and I dropped by the State House. As you walk up to the Massachusetts State House these days, the gold-domed building that faces on the historic Boston Common, right away, you know there's something up. From a distance, you begin to hear the chanting.
What do we want? Equal rights!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
Equal rights!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
Equal rights!
Everybody's circling around the State House, people who are going to work, coming from work, going to lunch, very aware of what's happening in Beacon Hill. There's a university right behind the State House. We stopped just before we went in to talk to a young woman.
People should be allowed to get married no matter who they are, and it offends me that it's even in question. I don't think it should even be in question.
So then we entered the State House itself. surprisingly minimal security. Kind of interesting considering the passion swirling around this building right now. And in short order, I ran into two priests.
I'm Father Terry Curley. I'm the pastor of St. Thomas Aquinas in the Hunt.
Father, what's your sense about how historic a moment this is?
I couldn't help but think, you know, in the 60s, you know, when I was a student and everything, and all of the demonstrations and it would be there, you know, against the war, and they'd say things like, the whole world is watching, you know. And I think in many ways that's what's happening, you know, the whole world is watching and wondering what's going to happen next. But what's really happening is we teach as a church the ends of marriage are two ends, really, mutual sanctification and the procreation of life, you know, if it's possible.
Another man wandered up to express his point of view about it all.
Mr. Ray Neary, N-E-A-R-Y. I'm from Medfield, Massachusetts, citizen of the Commonwealth. When I was married 40-plus years ago, it simply was taken for granted. You never thought otherwise. This has been the bedrock of our civilization.
We're shaking the bedrocks of civilization here in the State House in Massachusetts.
Absolutely. We are pulling a thread of the fabric which would unravel the entire blanket.
My name is Phil Clawson, and I'm a consultant. I have a consulting firm.
How much historical perspective do you bring to this? I mean, is this a blip on the historical radar screen, or is this a big historical deal here?
Well, you know, I think we've noticed over the last several hundred years a progression towards greater justice, basically for the minority that has been, you know, mistreated by the majority. And, you know, we've evolved through slavery and ending slavery, through the civil rights movement, through the women's suffrage movement.
This is right up there with slavery and women's suffrage movement.
Well, I wouldn't put this on par with ending slavery. I mean, I think that's a bigger deal, but I think that it's in the same trajectory.
My name is Catherine Archibald, and I'm really interested in this issue. I don't think that there should be discrimination, and definitely not in an amendment form. I think it's really progressive and great that the Supreme Court of the state decided that gay people should have equal rights as straight people. And I think for the legislator to decide to make an amendment to go against that would be against equality, against justice.
As you walk through the State House, one thing that you pass as you go along, governors of the Plymouth Colony dating back to 1644, that was Edward Winslow, then Josiah Winslow followed him to 1680, and all along the hall outside the Grand Rotunda, governor after governor, long before this state was even part of the United States or a state at all. What would these old Puritans think about what's going on Beacon Hill right now?
Now! What do we want? Equal rights!
Well, as we said earlier, the latest historic days on Boston's Beacon Hill begin again March 11th when the Constitutional Convention reconvenes.
Just ahead, we look back at the end of a sports dynasty.
And later in the show, Wesley Clark is out of the Democratic primary race. Who benefits?
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
This is NBA All-Star Weekend in Los Angeles. It's a three-day extravaganza with multimillionaire players and multi-millions of fans watching them. Boston University Assistant Professor Thomas Whalen chronicles a very different NBA in his new book, The Time, the Late 50s and 60s, The Place, Boston, which was basketball Shangri-La in some ways. The Boston Celtics in those years won 11 championships in 13 years, concluding with the 1968-69 season, when the Celtics managed only a fourth-place finish in the regular season, but beat the heavily favored Los Angeles Lakers in the finals. But it's the story behind that magic time that Whalen writes about, the very unmagical environment the Celtics played in. His book is called Dynasty's End. Thomas Whalen joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Tom, a lot of books about the great Celtics teams. What moved you to write another one, first off?
Well, there was many Celtics books, but never any one book that combined all the elements, I think, that made the Celtics dynasty so unique and great in the 1960s.
They're more sort of the glory of the sports team. And this book is very much about the social context in which it all happened. You're a social scientist, after all.
Right. It's the social context. And in many ways, it's kind of a morality play about the team and what it represented in the 1960s. Because it's my argument in the book that they represented the liberal values that the 1960s were supposed to be about. Integration, equality, because unlike other sports franchises of that era, they were color-free in looking at a player, looking how a player will contribute to a team's success.
At the heart of this great team, a man named Bill Russell, raised in Louisiana, mm-hmm. raised in the Jim Crow South. Tell us very briefly about Bill Russell.
Well, Bill Russell is an extraordinary man, tremendous character and intellect. He basically came to basketball late in his life. He was a teenager when he picked up basketball, and he wasn't really until his senior year in high school that he showed any type of real concerted ability. But from his senior year, he developed enough skills that he got the notice of a local scout for the University of San Francisco. And once he arrived at the University of San Francisco, he took off in a basketball sense.
He became a great player.
Right, and he also, at every stage of his life, including his years at the University of San Francisco, encountered racism. For example, there was a tournament in Oklahoma City in the 1950s, and Russell and a number of African-American teammates had to face the Oklahoma fans pitching pennies at them before their game started. And Russell, he very defiantly gathered all the change together and handed it to the coach and said, "Coach, save this for our victory celebration after the game." And then Russell, leading the way, proceeded to demolish the team that they played that night in defiance of those racist Oklahoma fans.
We can almost forget what radical and daring behavior that was at that time. Let's get to this team. Mm-hmm. The Celtics of the late 50s and 60s. What made this team so difficult to beat for a very long time in a sport? 13 years their great run went on for.
Well, first and foremost, they had good coaching, and they had intelligent players. Red Auerbach was the man who put the team together, and he didn't necessarily look at outstanding offensive or defensive skills. He looked at a player who was diverse in his talents, who could score and defend, but also, more importantly, who could make decisions on the run when a game heats up.
So here you have this superb team. Mm-hmm. The Boston Garden is hardly ever full. There are photographs in your book of a moment in a Celtics game, and you look at the stands, and they're half full.
Right, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the racial climate was so extreme in Boston at that time. The Celtics barely drew half of the Garden's capacity during their glory years, during the regular season.
And that was because they were black players?
Right. I think Boston at that time, given the racial environment and given its intense history of racial problems, was unable to accept a team where the dominant players, the star players, key role players, were African American.
Was that different when they played in other cities?
The Celtics were a major draw in all the other cities, particularly places like New York and Philadelphia. People would flock to see the Celtics because they were the world champions.
Bill Russell had an ambivalent relationship, to say the least, with the city of Boston.
I think he had good reason to, because when he lived here, he was the subject of extreme prejudice and racism. He lived north of Boston in a suburb of Reading, and when he was coming back from a weekend trip, he had spent a weekend away, his house had been broken into, his trophies smashed, a racial epithet had been spray-painted on his wall, and someone actually had defecated in his bed. And when he tried to move into a better section of Reading, given his prominence as salary increases over the 1960s, a petition circulated in the community to prevent him from moving into this all-white exclusive area. And, you know, he constantly faced that every moment of his time here in Boston. One of the lead writers for the Boston Globe would go into the press box during Celtics games and crack jokes about how, you know, we're going to watch tonight African handball. You know, by our modern standards, it's so appalling.
Why did he stick with the Celtics? Wouldn't he have had alternatives over the years, a player that great?
He certainly did, but he loved the Celtics. And even though Boston was a racist city, the organization was not. The organization supported him.
Did Bill Russell and the city of Boston find a level of peace with each other eventually?
Yes, eventually. And by 1999, it's interesting to point out they had a ceremony to rededicate his number, re-retire his number. And during this ceremony, an amazing thing happened. When Russell was being greeted by the fans, a fan just shouted out spontaneously, "We love you, Bill." And Russell, who always kept a close check on his emotions in public, really began to get emotional, and he said, "I love you too." And in fact, I think it's important to realize that Boston itself had changed by 1999. It no longer was the Boston of the 1960s. And now it's an ethnically rich, diverse city. And I think Russell played a role in creating that better environment for all of us.
Thomas Whalen, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thomas Whalen is an assistant professor of social science at Boston University and the author of Dynasty's End, Bill Russell and the 1968-69 World Champion Boston Celtics.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Political combat joined on a number of fronts this week, from clearly serious and significant developments in the Democratic primaries to other issues, sort of, scandal stuff, which many consider scurrilous, though as we've seen in years past, the seemingly scurrilous can take on a political life of its own and become significant. And this is a campaign year expected to be no holds barred. We're joined now by Dorothy Rabinowitz, editorial board member of the Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Dorothy.
Thanks very much.
And Nolan Finley of the Detroit News. He's the editorial page editor there. Hi, Nolan.
Hey, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm good. And thanks both of you for joining us. Dorothy, victories for a northerner, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, in the southern states of Virginia and Tennessee this week, defeating impressively John Edwards of North Carolina. Now, Kerry's been quoted, Dorothy, as you know, in recent weeks as saying a Democrat can win the White House without the South. He may have regretted that remark, but how important was it to show his stuff anyway in Virginia and Tennessee?
I don't think it's very important. I mean, he had the momentum, and contrary to the charm offensive that John Edwards launched, there are a lot of people quietly walking around thinking that this is a character who has been put together in a robot factory or some other planetary place.
Which guy do you mean?
John Edwards.
John Edwards, okay.
Yeah. His charm has left a lot of people unaffected.
Nolan, your thoughts on the importance of what was, you know, touted as an important step for Kerry in some circles, because he is sort of the ultimate Boston Brahmin. He needed to win somewhere in the South. He did.
Well, right now, Kerry is the default candidate. I think the Democrats took a look at the field and said this is the only guy that has any sort of a chance to win or any sort of a prayer for national appeal. A primary is a different animal than a general election, and if he's going to win the general election, he is going to have to appeal to Southern voters and Midwestern voters and Western voters. That's still an unknown when it comes to John Kerry. The sudden collapse of Howard Dean left him more or less untested, really.
Nolan, are there any unknowns left in this Democratic race?
Well,
besides the vice presidency?
They call them unknowns, you know. Who knows what sort of bomb's going to drop?
Yeah, we'll get to that later.
John Kerry's high level of self—you call him a Brahmin. Brahmins don't stay on this level of high self-righteous rhetoric. If I sit around thinking to myself, I cannot spend 9 months listening to this level.
Yes.
I can't listen to him. I, of course...
The rhetoric is too high flown for you?
Well, the rhetoric is too high flown. The voice is this grinding self-righteousness that he learned in his post-Vietnam War, you know, recreation as a moralist and struggler and defamer of Vietnam War veterans, only now changing his mind, of course.
Some would call him much more eloquent than the President of the United States.
Eloquent? I mean, he is, as a rhetorician, yes, he has a capacity to string a lot of sentences together, but they are the same repetitious sentences, all of them ending with that very classy, we're coming, you're going, and don't let the door slam in your face. That's really presidential.
Well, someone who went this week, Nolan, was Wesley Clark. Nolan, word is he'll support Kerry. Now, Clark was the Clintons' candidate. What's the importance of this endorsement, and what is your sense of where the Clintons stand and in relation to Senator Kerry?
There were a lot of people thought Wesley Clark was the answer. You know, he was the outsider with military experience and the maturity, integrity, and leadership skills to take on George Bush, and he turned out to be more or less an empty uniform. I think he was the most surprising disappointment of this race. Once he got in the race, he didn't have much to say, and all those people that were pushing him in, including the Clintons, didn't seem to want to get all that close to him after he jumped in.
He did seem to have some juice at the start there, Dorothy, right?
Oh, no. From the start, I was prepared to see an alternative, but when you compared him to Howard Dean's straightforward, insane views, but which came from a character that seemed integrated and a personality that seemed integrated, Wesley Clark gave me, if I may be so bold, the creeps.
Well, Dorothy, you bring up Howard Dean. He says now he will fight on beyond the Wisconsin primary this coming Tuesday, which he had said earlier would be his Waterloo if he lost. Now, he's got some delegates, and he's got some very hardcore support. Is he a problem for Kerry?
I hope he's a problem, but more than anything, I hope he's a candidate, because he actually articulates a choice that people can make. And he can think on his feet. Have you ever heard Howard Dean, even in his last moments? He connects one thought with another, and they all mean something.
Nolan, is there any chance that Howard Dean is hanging out, waiting for some sort of Kerry implosion? What's driving him at this point?
Well, I think now that the field has narrowed to more or less two candidates, I expect Edwards to go soon. But once that field narrows to two candidates, perhaps he's hoping that, you know, he'll have a better shot of getting an honest comparison with Kerry. And I agree with Dorothy. Kerry's going to wear thin. He sounds very much like he's doing Williams Jennings Bryan in a one-man play, you know, and I'm not sure we can stand that long. And, you know, it was a very noisy field at first, and now that it's narrowed down, maybe Howard Dean feels that people start listening to him again.
You know, there's a lot of issues out there, guys. War, unemployment, health care, education. But who's kidding who? All week, there were new headlines about whether President Bush fulfilled his military obligation in Vietnam. A photograph surfaced from Republican sources of John Kerry at an anti-war rally back in the 70s that featured Jane Fonda. And this morning, John Kerry was on the Imus in the Morning program categorically denying an allegation on the Drudge website that political reporters all over the country are looking into of an affair a couple of years ago between Kerry and a young woman. Your thoughts on all that, Dorothy?
Well, I was thinking, even as you spoke, that I would rather look at those pictures and than listen to any more debates. If this is what we're going to have, let's get to it, and let's get it over with. And my thoughts are that, of course, President's National Guard duty is, in my view, wholly nonsensical. And you've got, nevertheless, a lot of, you know, the usual journalists cranked up. And if there is a bimbo eruption, I think we will live through it. But all that will be behind us.
Would Kerry live through it?
Well, yes. Well, did
I mean, as
Bill
a candidate?
Clinton live through it? And any number of them, Kerry could live through one of them, whether Mrs. Kerry could live through it, if it is the case. I have a strong feeling she might smack him with her serape.
Yeah, I think he's got more to worry about at home than he does on the campaign trail.
Yeah,
this is true.
But is this what we're going to get, Nolan, do you think? At the end of the day, it somehow becomes inexorable that these kinds of issues predominate?
It's what we always get. But and they may predominate, but they don't resonate. You, these same allegations and same accusations were raised against Bill Clinton about his sexual appetites and his lack of military service, and it never hurt him. Sooner or later, we'll learn that, you know, although this is very prurient, it's not very effective in terms of tearing down a candidate. This won't hurt George Bush, particularly the Vietnam stuff. America understands that that was a very painful and divisive period, and, you know, I think the first stone rule will apply here.
Dorothy Rabinowitz, editorial board member of The Wall Street Journal. Dorothy, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
And Nolan Finley, editorial page editor of the Detroit News. Thanks, Nolan.
Good to be with you.
Thanks to you both.
Still to come, love, politics, and film in Paris in 1968. Bernardo Bertolucci's new film, The Dreamers.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
We've received a lot of response to the issue of gay marriage and civil unions being debated in the Massachusetts State House. Last fall, the state Supreme Court ruled that gay marriage is a constitutional right. And now the state legislature is debating amendments to the Constitution to stop gay marriage. Mary Morsel, a self-proclaimed straight 68-year-old grandmother from Medford, Oregon, had this response. I think the government should not mix religion and politics. If any particular church or other religious entity is against gay unions, that's their right, and the government should butt out. However, I think gay unions must have the force of federal law to be recognized in all 50 states and to receive all benefits. If a given religious organization wishes to call such unions marriage, it's up to them. It's so hypocritical to discriminate against gay unions while spending millions of dollars to promote marriage. If the administration thinks it's a good idea to strengthen family units, then all family units must be included.
And the ongoing move to amend the Massachusetts Constitution to define marriage solely between a man and a woman prompted this call.
Hi, my name is Lisbeth Applefield. I live in Scottsdale, Arizona. I am a constitutional scholar. I do not ever recall reading any amendments or any part of the Constitution that does anything but preserve a human's right to individual freedom. Any constitutional amendments reducing, diminishing, limiting a person's, a human being's rights is to defile the Constitution.
Well, we also received a lot of response to our discussion of the exposure of Janet Jackson's breast, which I referred to as an assault, one that was simulated for entertainment and choreographed by Jackson. Dan McMahon of Tucson, Arizona, took issue, saying, "Justin Timberlake assaulted Janet Jackson? I find your assessment ridiculous. I don't see how anyone can call two professional entertainers, both adults, performing a pre-planned routine an assault. Our country has a lot more pressing issues than this to repair. Let's move on."
But a number of listeners agreed with the description. Jay Potter writes, "Thank you for speaking up for women who are outraged by the Super Bowl halftime show. I wasn't outraged by the exposure of Janet Jackson's breasts in itself. Who among us has not seen a breast before? However, I was strongly offended by the song with its simulated assault. Yes, I think you did use the right word. Not only were there children watching, but this is a day with a high occurrence of reported domestic abuse. I'm appalled that the demeaning of women was part of the entertainment at such an event. I am not a Republican family values person. I am a woman who was personally offended by the demeaning of women."
Well, as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please remember to include your full name, your phone number, and your town.
4, 3, 2, 1.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here on Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Bernardo Bertolucci's The Dreamers is a tale of young love and sexual awakening set in Paris in the spring of 1968, a time when millions of students and workers in France took to the streets in a general strike. In the film, Matthew, an American, chides his Parisian friend Theo, who professes Marxism but stays in the safety of his apartment.
If you really believed what you were saying, you'd be out there.
Where?
Out there on the street.
I don't know what you mean.
Yes, you do. There's something going on out there. Something that feels like it could be really important. Something that feels like things could change. Even I get that. But you're not out there. You're inside with me, drinking expensive wine, talking about film, talking about Maoism. Why?
Okay, that's enough.
No, tell me why.
That's enough.
Ask yourself why.
We'll have a review of Bertolucci's The Dreamers in just a moment, but first, to learn more about the real events that took place in Paris in May of 1968, we turn to Sylvia Harvey, a professor of broadcasting at the University of Lincoln, England, and author of the definitive book, May 68 and Film Culture. Welcome, Professor Harvey.
Hello, it's very nice to speak to you.
Well, I'm reminded as well of 1968, a tumultuous year around the world. In the U.S., the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy. Also in 68, the Soviet Union's invasion of Czechoslovakia, the Prague Spring, and then Paris. Set the scene for us in Paris in 68.
Well, the May events, of course, were before the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia, but I think it started with a student occupation at the University of Nanterre, and the students in France were protesting, I think, against the war in Vietnam, and things rather snowballed from there. I think it was very unformulated, really. It wasn't the way that political parties operate. It was a kind of almost unspeakable desire for something very, very different. Somehow everything was wrong, so they couldn't quite point to in particular what was wrong.
But in fact, they touched on something because, as you said, they were joined by others. The labor force joined them. There were a series of factory strikes and occupations. And before long, 10 million workers were on strike.
Yes. Yes, that's right. It was a quite extraordinary moment in French history when the whole status quo, the whole order of things seemed to be in the balance. It seemed to be possible that everything could change.
How did those strikes affect film?
Well, I think they affected filmmakers. As you probably know, the Cannes Film Festival, a big international event and market, was closed down in that year by French filmmakers who thought that it was somehow a rather superficial sort of event. And so a number of filmmakers like Jean-Luc Godard and Marion Karmitz and others spent time going into the factories and filming what was going on there and having a different sense of what it meant to be French, I suppose.
They were ridiculed, the students, by those on both the far left and the right. Why?
Well, I suppose the people on the far left thought they weren't serious politically and the people on the right thought they were disturbing the sanctity of the French state.
They did not, as the far left would have liked, overthrow the De Gaulle government. The De Gaulle called parliamentary elections and the movement lost momentum. But did they, in effect, at least as history would judge them, did the student strikers win?
Well, I think in a way, ideologically, they did, because the changes that have taken place in Western society since then have been quite enormous. And I think the events of 1968 played a part in that big culture shift. The government was reinstated, but I think the world was never the same again.
Mm. Professor Harvey, thank you.
Pleasure.
Professor Sylvia Harvey's book is called May 68 and Film Culture. Well, we turn now to Here and Now film reviewer Eric Schaefer. And Eric, you just heard Professor Harvey speaking. Did you see the impact of the student uprisings on the filmmakers?
Oh, certainly. She mentioned Jean-Luc Godard, who, of course, goes on to found the Ziga Vertov group, which was a group that made these sort of radical film essays that they showed at labor halls and so on. And so for a little while, there was that sort of radicalization. And then later, Godard was making Blue Jeans commercials.
So there you have it. Well, so now Bernardo Bertolucci has made a film with the strikes as a backdrop. Tell us about The Dreamers. What's the plot?
Well, the plot involves Matthew, this young American student who's come to study French in Paris, and he's a big film buff, constantly going to the Cinémathèque. And when that's shut down, he meets these two French students about his own age, brother and sister, named Theo and Isabel. And they sort of take Matthew under their wing, and he becomes kind of a part of their lives. They bring him home and, you know, even introduce Matthew to their parents, and they, you know, sit around and have intellectual conversations like people did back in 1968.
I was noticing that the more you look at it, everything, this table, the objects on it, the refrigerator, this room, your nose, the world, suddenly you realize that there's some sort of cosmic harmony of shapes and sizes. I was just wondering why. I don't know why that is. I know that it is.
You have an interesting friend here.
The parents leave for the seashore for a month, and Theo and Isabel invite Matthew to come and live with them, and they become involved in this very sort of strange relationship. Theo and Isabel have this almost semi-incestuous relationship. Matthew becomes involved in that, and we really wind up with this very sort of erotic, oppressive, claustrophobic sort of affair in this Parisian apartment while the riots are beginning to rage outside in the streets.
In the time-honored tradition of Bertolucci, when you say that it's erotic, he, of course, made Last Tango in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And this film has been rated NC-17, first time this rating has been used in more than 6 years. First of all, why? I mean, how intense is it?
Well, the film is pretty frank. It has some very erotic scenes, full frontal nudity, both men and women, simulated sex. So this is a film that is deserving of that NC-17 rating.
What do you think he's saying? I mean, I'm immediately thinking an American and a European stuck in this apartment. Is there supposed to be something?
There is supposed to be something, but I guess that's the biggest problem I had with the film is that it's not entirely clear what Bertolucci is trying to say. The three main characters spend a lot of time talking about revolution and so on, but they never really engage in it, you know, until the very end. What really, you know, fascinates them, what they spend most of their time talking about are movies. There are three dyed-in-the-wool movie buffs, and, you know, where the real joy of this film comes in is in its sort of evocation of that time when people were really immersed in cinema. And so there are some great scenes where Bertolucci cuts in segments from old movies like Blonde Venus and Shock Corridor and Freaks and even the Godard film Band Apart.
You see, my little Matthew, there's something Theo and I have been meaning to do for a long time, but we've been waiting for the right person to do it with. And I think you're finally it.
To do what?
Try to beat the record of Bonaparte.
What record?
Well, you've seen Bonaparte, haven't you?
Yeah?
You remember the scene where the three of them race through the Louvre?
Vaguely, remind me.
And they try to beat the world record of 9 minutes and 45 seconds.
Oh, yeah, of course, of course.
We're going to beat their record.
A scene from Bertolucci's The Dreamers. All I can think of, Eric Schaefer, is here's this extraordinary event going on right outside, and they're talking about film. I think of Plato's The Shadow on the Wall, that they're looking at the shadows on the wall, but they're not seeing the real thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that certainly, you know, is a part of this movie. I just wish that, you know, Bertolucci and the writer, Gilbert Adair, who actually wrote the novel on which this is based, had just been a little bit more explicit about what they were trying to get across. I think that the, you know, eroticism sort of diverts them a little bit too much, perhaps, from, you know, the political point that they were trying to make with this film. And it's not to say that this is a bad film. It's got some really interesting moments in it, but it just does not quite gel to the degree that you'd like it to. Certainly it doesn't gel to the degree that a lot of Bertolucci's work in the past has, like Last Tango in Paris or The Conformist.
Mm. Eric, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Here now, film reviewer Eric Schaefer. We've been talking about The Dreamers, the new Bernardo Bertolucci film. It opens in selected cities today.
Won't you let me hold you, babe? Hey, hey.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
Happy Valentine's Day tomorrow, and don't let this Friday the 13th throw you, and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.